Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for inviting me to be your speaker before these high holy days. I'm very much aware of the high honor that you've paid to me because I see the distinguished company that I've now joined. And I'm grateful to Ari and to everybody else who has made this possible, and to our host and hostess for giving us their very beautiful home. I'd like to begin, ladies and gentlemen, by suggesting that this period of the High Holy Days is not limited, as most people think, to Rosh Hashanah, the 10 days of penitence, and Yom Kippur, but that it begins a month earlier, at the beginning of the month of Elul, and that it continues, believe it or not, to the very end of Sukkot, to Hoshana Rabbah. And I have a number of questions about this extensive period. Firstly, since in rabbinic tradition, this is a single period of penitence, which begins with the sounding of the shofar from Rosh Chodesh of Elul every single morning, the recitation of Psalm 27, which includes a reference to the Sukkah. The question is, how is it that a period of such disparate moods as the solemnity of Rosh Hashanah, the fasting and the introspection of Yom Kippur, are juxtaposed in a single penitential period with the feasting of Sukkot? And I'm going to begin by posing a question which was asked in one of the earliest books of Jewish law, which is called the Torah. In this book, the author, Rabbi Yechiel ben Asher, asks why it is that Sukkot is celebrated in the fall, when Sukkot is supposed to commemorate the shelters, the booths, perhaps the clouds of glory that protected the Jewish people in our wanderings through the wilderness between the Exodus from Egypt and the crossing of the River Jordan into the Promised Land. And his question is, wouldn't it have been more appropriate to celebrate Sukkot, the festival of these booths, of this protection, soon after Pesach, when we left Egypt? And he suggests an answer which, on the face of it, doesn't make that much sense. He says, when the weather is warm, when it's beautiful outside, it's no big deal for people to sit in a sukkah, to take shelter outside under the leafy cover and to enjoy their meals together. The real test of faith, he says, is when it begins to blow cold and there is a hint of winter in the air, and when it is uncomfortable. If you then can leave your homes and go into your sukkah, that's a demonstration of your faith. Problem is, ladies and gentlemen, that it may have worked in his experience in the climate in which he lived. It certainly didn't work in the climate in which I grew up in South Africa, where the nicest time of the year was Sukkot. It was, in fact, the beginning of the spring. It doesn't work in Israel, where Sukkot is usually glorious. And it certainly doesn't work in Southern California, where we've occasionally had to abandon our sukkah because it's too hot. So it seemed to me that perhaps there is an answer which is even more compelling. And it's my attempt to answer his question which leads me into the whole notion of teshuvah. And in order to frame it, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to share what has become fairly commonplace in Jewish knowledge, and that is my great teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik's picture of the human being. He notices, ladies and gentlemen, that there seem to be two stories of creation in the book of Genesis. In the first story of creation, in Genesis chapter 1, Adam and Eve are created together. It says, "Let us make man in our image. Male and female created he them." Together. It says, and I emphasize, that he is, and she is, the first man, the first woman created, Betzalmenu Kidmutenu, in our image and after our likeness. The word for God which is used in this first chapter is Elohim, which denotes power. El means power in Hebrew. The mandate which is given to Adam and Eve in chapter 1 is to conquer the earth and to subdue it. That's the story in the first chapter of Genesis. The second chapter of Genesis has an entirely different account, which you know and with which every school child is familiar. It is a description of a very lonely man who is placed in the midst of the garden and who wanders around the garden naming all the animals. And God notices something which was absent from the first chapter, and that is the loneliness of this first man. And God makes a value judgment. He says, "Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado," which is normally translated in your Bibles, "It is not good for man to be alone." Bad translation. A much better translation, "Heyot ha'adam levado," the condition of man's being alone. Man's being alone is lo tov. The loneliness of the human condition is not good. E'eseh lo ezer kenegdo, I shall make him a helpmeet. And then the well-known story that Adam is cast down to the ground. A deep sleep overwhelms him. Part of his body is removed. And when he wakes up, God introduces him to his Eve. And they're given a different mandate. not to subdue the world and to conquer it, but to tend the garden and to keep it. Now, there are a number of differences between the account of the creation of Adam in chapter 1 of Bereshit and in chapter 2. In chapter 1, Adam is majestic. He's in the image of God. In chapter 2, he is vulnerable. He is lonely. In chapter 1, he is created together with his Eve, associates and partners in the work of the conquest of the environment. In chapter 2, he has to make a sacrifice of part of himself in order to get his Eve. He is vulnerable, he is lonely, he is humble. There is not one mention of the fact that he's created in the image of God. Even the name of God in chapter 2 is different from the name which is used in chapter 1. In chapter 1, as I said, it's Elohim. In chapter 2, it's Hashem Elohim, the Lord God. Elohim meaning power, as I said. The Lord God meaning intimacy and closeness. Now, how do we account, asks Rabbi Soloveitchik, for the fact that our Bible, which is the most carefully edited text that one can find, seems to have two such contradictory images of the human being? He says, Bible critics have seized upon this in order to say there were really two stories. And the editor somehow fused them together, one in one chapter and the other in another chapter. And this proves that the Bible was composed of multiple documents, each document using a different name of God, as the higher critic said. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, it is difficult to conceive of an editor who would have been so clumsy as to have left two contradictory accounts in place in two successive chapters, because any child would be able to see that they were contradictory and that they were not the same story. And therefore, suggests Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his breathtaking The Lonely Man of Faith, what we have here is not two accounts of the creation of Adam and Eve, but two types of Adam and Eve. Two Adams. The majestic Adam of chapter 1, created in the image of God, which means autonomous, which means creative, which means ultimately independent, because as God is independent of any other force and transcends any other force, there is something in human nature which pushes us to be independent, to be autonomous, to bristle when anybody tries to limit our freedom. To be created majestically in the image of God means that we have the intelligence, the cognitive ability, we have the willpower, we have the motivation to get out and to build. And this aspect of the human being, powerful and majestic, is homotechnos, the technical master, the scientific investigator, the explorer, the person who sees the Garden of Eden and says, what gems does this ground conceal? What potential fuels does it hold? What powers can be unlocked? Let us take the garden and analyze it and break up its atoms and release its power. This is the majestic Adam. Finding partners, and primarily the Eve that's born with him. If you like, that is Adam the builder. Adam who takes a hostile environment and subdues it, who is able to coexist in a world with fierce animals by devising the technological means to defend himself from the animals and to bring the animals to a point of extinction. It's the Adam who can live in the hottest of hot climates and learn to cool down his dwelling, or in the coldest of cold climates and learn to warm up his dwelling. It's the Adam who can take disease and say, this is a challenge to be conquered. It is the Adam who can look up at the heavens and see the moon and say, I will walk on it one day. It is the Adam for whom almost all things are possible. It's the Adam of whom the great American poet John Algernon Swinburne, taking the old Christian hymn, Glory to God in the highest, the maker and the master of all things, could literally say, Glory to man in the highest, the maker and the master of all things. It is the Adam who is not only created in the image of God, but because he is driven to independence, bristles at being bound by regulations which have been made by God. It is the Adam who godlike challenges God for dominion. It is the Adam of whom Bertrand Russell could say, he created God in his image. It is the Adam who brooks no limitation. And the second Adam is the vulnerable Adam, the lonely Adam. The Adam who looks at his environment and says, if I don't preserve it, I perish with it. If I merely exploit it, I will ultimately be exploiting my survivability. And here's the rub, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. Adam the builder and Adam the farmer are really the same Adam and the same Eve. That each one of us oscillates between two poles of our existence. A sense of majesty and accomplishment on the one hand, and a sense of vulnerability and frailty and transience and evanescence on the other hand. Because Adam the vulnerable understands that Adam the majestic can be in the midst of the creation of a magnificent bridge which is to stand for centuries, realizing all the possibilities of his scientific technical knowledge, when suddenly he feels a burning pain in his head. And in a moment, he stops creating. And when he wakes up and tries to speak, this tool of power, this instrument of communication, which was his power and his majesty, is gone. Because the stroke has left him silent. These arms, which could draw drawings, are suddenly paralyzed. Or the great investigator who's sitting in the laboratory feels godlike in his or her discovery of the secrets of the human genome, when suddenly, unexpectedly, on a regular visit to her physician or his physician, confronts the grim look on the physician's face and knows that something has gone wrong. And suddenly, when he is told or she is told that one cell has begun to multiply out of control and is consuming his or her body, suddenly the investigation pales. The scientific papers become unimportant. And clutching on to that tenuous life becomes the most important of all projects. The majesty is suddenly brought low. And the recognition that we are not independent, that we are not completely autonomous, that we are not altogether in control, suddenly floods our consciousness. And the reality is, ladies and gentlemen, that we move, we oscillate between an awareness of our power and our dominance and our mastery and our ability to build and conquer and our desire to be free of the restraints and limitations of those things which would control the way we live, and the sense of our vulnerability, the intimation of our transience, the understanding suddenly that we are creature as much as creator, needy as much as fulfiller of needs. And it is this duality in our nature and in our experience, ladies and gentlemen, which I believe is the foundation of this entire period spanning the beginning of Elul to the end of Sukkot. And let me explain why. For the most part, ladies and gentlemen, when we are well, when we are fit, when we are creative and when we are productive, we don't have the consciousness of that other aspect of our being, of the lonely, vulnerable Adam in us, or Eve in us. We are, for the most part, builders of our own lives and builders of our environment and our worlds. The mood of the High Holy Days is to provide us with a consciousness gradually and the tools gradually for discovering that other disowned part of ourselves which connects us creatures with our Creator, which instead of fighting to be free longs for the security of the divine embrace. It starts with a wake-up call, which lasts for 30 days, which says, you're so busy. You're so preoccupied with your tasks of subduing and mastering your environment that you've forgotten that other inner part of yourself. So wake up. Wake up and start thinking about who you really are in the universe and how powerful or powerless you really are in the universe. And this is the mood which leads us into the days before Rosh Hashanah, which just began for most of us last night. The mood of Selichot, where we are able to examine ourselves and to say, we are sorry for having brushed aside others, for having cast aside restriction, for having been selfish, for having been so autonomous that we are not aware of how much we depend upon one another. The mood of Rosh Hashanah is fundamentally twofold. In the first instance, ladies and gentlemen, it is the recognition of the difference between man who is created in the image of God and God. And that's why the key word in our liturgy over the Rosh Hashanah prayers is HaMelech, reminding us that we are not king. That although we imagine ourselves to be powerful, that the unexpected can occur at any moment. And this is the second theme of Rosh Hashanah. Perhaps the most soaring moment of the liturgy and the most searing moment of the liturgy is the so-called Unatana Tokef prayer, where the liturgical poet imagines a process of judgment. in which each one of us passes before our Maker. And it says, Mi yichyeh umi yamut. Who will live and who will die? Because for the most part, while we are creative, while we are busy, while we are doing, while we are making, while we are busy, while we are subduing our environments, we don't think of our mortality. We don't think of our transience. We don't imagine that we are evanescent here today and gone tomorrow, that suddenly an event can happen which will make us realize how weak and frail we really are, how dependent we really are, how frightened we really are. And the poet says, not only mi yichyeh, mi yamut, mi yichyeh, who will live and who will die? The poet says, mi bi'ito, umi lo bi'ito. Who in the appointed time and who not? Who will live to experience the joys and pleasures of a ripe old age, of children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? And who will suddenly be torn away from family? Who will suddenly become the victim of fire and flood? Who will drown? And Rosh Hashanah reminds us not only that He is King, but that we are dependent. Yom Kippur continues this theme, ladies and gentlemen. Do you know why we fast? It's not an exercise in dieting. It is a pre-experience of our mortality. We do without food and drink for 25 hours. And we realize suddenly how vulnerable we are. In this short period of time, we experience what it feels to be faint, because we are not fed. To be parched because we don't drink. Some of us dress in white, symbolizing our own shrouds. It's a pre-experience of our mortality. And then comes that peculiar requirement in Jewish tradition, that the moment we end our fast, we put the first nail into our sukkah. As if there is a juxtaposition of that paradox of fasting and feasting, of solemnity and celebration, of inwardness and v'hayita ach sameach, and joyfulness. And what is really happening, ladies and gentlemen, in that moment of switching from Yom Kippur, from solemnity to simcha, what we're doing is moving from our experience the whole year long of Adam and Eve, the builder, who exploit the environment, to Adam and Eve, the farmer, who preserve the environment. Because we're told to leave our homes and to go into flimsy structures. And yes, the real law is to live in these structures for 7 days.
7 years. Oy, oy, oy.
To live in these structures for 7 days, where the rain can come in, and there is more shade than light, and you can see the stars through the schach, because, ladies and gentlemen, there is nobody on earth who understands our dependence upon God more than does the farmer. No matter what our technology, if the rains don't come when they should come, the crops become parched and die. If the rains come when they shouldn't come, the deluge washes away the produce. If it is cold when it shouldn't be cold, the frost eats away. And we cannot control the frost. And we cannot control the heat. And we cannot control the rain. Isn't this our experience now over these past 3 weeks as we watch the course of hurricane after hurricane and the total vulnerability of people in their homes, boarding their homes and asked to leave their homes? The farmer understands this. And we are asked to experience the experience of the farmer, which is the second Adam, the second Eve. Dependence. Faith. And this is why, ladies and gentlemen, the designer of the Jewish calendar, who seemed to have made such a mess up, putting all these Yom Tovs into 1 month, really was so insightful. They represent a move from power to dependence. A raising of our consciousness to our neediness. But, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to take this just a little further with some insights from my clinical practice. Are we really happy as Adam won? Are we really fulfilled in our successful creativity? What is the origin of some of our strategies for success? I'd like to give you one or two case examples from people who've come to my office. In fact, these case examples are actually retold in a new book which Random House will be bringing out next fall of mine. Two different stories. The first is the story of a woman who came to one of my spiritual course seminars, a 3-day workshop, which utilized the techniques of ancient Kabbalah and modern psychology, contemporary psychology, to try and find relief which had not been given by normal psychological interventions, by the usual psychological interventions. This woman, on the face of it, was abundantly successful. She had been a brilliant student, made law review, was climbing on the ladder of her law firm and was soon to be made partner, had a lovely guy who wanted to marry her. And who came to the spiritual course because she was dreadfully unhappy. On the face of it, she had everything to be happy about. She was doing everything that Adam and Eve the first would have exalted. A successful academic career, a stellar professional career. In her 20s, headed for partner in a major law firm. A wonderful young man wanting to be her husband. And yet she was terribly unhappy. And in fact, she reflects a universal, paradoxical lack of happiness, ladies and gentlemen. Because the truth is that we live at a time when it is so easy on the face of it for us to be really happy. Technology has made our lives more and more comfortable. Psychology and psychiatry have produced interventions and pills which are supposed to take away our depression and to remove our anxieties. And those who've made it have made it bigger than their parents made it and their grandparents made it. They have been successful, and yet in spite of so much success, there is so much unhappiness. I had a colleague in London, ladies and gentlemen, who became quite famous. She's now in the United States teaching in one of the business schools, a psychologist, who discovered a new disease. She called it affluenza. I guess you haven't heard of it. I should tell her that there's a market in Orange County. Affluenza was the dis-ease of the affluent. The fact that so many of them felt that they had neglected their families in order to rise on the corporate ladder. That so many of them were guilty about having to have axed so many others in order that they should be successful and their company should be successful. Who felt guilty about having so much when some people had so little. Whatever it was, affluenza. And she was in all the glossy magazines in London, came to one of my lectures. And at the end of the lecture, she said, "I'd like to talk to you. I've been missing something in my therapeutic approach. And that is that perhaps the root of the problem is that underneath the veneer of success, there has been a spiritual emptiness." And we began to collaborate, meeting every week for many months. Let's come back to our law student. We asked her, what was her first memory of loss or disappointment?
nothing dramatic. Her parents were still alive. Fairly affluent. But she said her first memory was when she was 2 or 3 years old. She had done something good and her father took her out to buy her an ice cream in reward. She remembered he was wearing a white summer suit. And she was so excited to get the ice cream that she reached across him, pulled it towards her, and the chocolate spilt all over his suit. And without thinking, he turned to her and said, "You're so clumsy, you'll never be good at anything." Twenty-five years later, that silly little comment echoed in her head. You know why? Because when her marks had not been perfect at school, because she had this great potential, she would come home and she would hear from her parents, "Why only 9 out of 10? And from her teacher, "Do it again because you can be perfect." And this was her experience growing up. Do you know what she became? She became perfect. She became the perfect little girl. She was able to please everybody. She became the perfect student, able to excel at everything. She became the perfect member of the law review. She became the perfect member of the law firm. Because her strategy for success was to be perfect, and she was perfect by being in her head. She knew exactly what skills to master. She was so brilliant at her analysis that she was all head and no heart. She was able to analyze everybody who wanted to come close to her and find something wrong. She used her head to paralyze her heart. But worse, she kept hearing those criticisms, and she, beneath this veneer of perfection, she was filled with a gnawing fear that she was clumsy, that she wasn't really perfect, that one day somebody would discover who she really was. And you know why she couldn't commit to this guy? Because she was afraid when he discovered that she wasn't the perfect person that she had made herself out to be, that he would no longer want her. Now, when we asked her in the workshop, "How would your friends describe you?" And at first she was a little bashful, but he said, "Be honest." She said, "Driven, motivated, accomplished, a perfectionist, and also a pleaser." She was to others exactly what she had wanted to be. Her persona, her personality, her ego was a cover-up, a series of infantile defenses, which may have been good when she was a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, but which were keeping her crippled and unhappy underneath that veneer of success. Another story, the last one. Although I could regale you with similar stories the whole night long. A little boy. Last remembers his father when he was about 4 years old. The father suddenly disappears. And the little boy and his sister, aged 2, are told that the father has died. The little boy grows up without any male role model. Nobody teaches him how to kick a football. It's a big deal for him to get into the local soccer team. He tries out and fails. What does he do? He makes his own soccer team, designs a uniform, invites people to try out, and creates a whole Sunday league, this 8-year-old, so that he will learn to play soccer and get into the school soccer team. He gets beaten up by the neighborhood bully over and over again. Nobody shows him how to defend himself until one day he gets himself almost paralyzed by this bully's headlock. And he notes every move, learning exactly how the guy is half murdering him. The next time he's bullied, he gets the other guy into the same headlock first. Goes right through school, doing better than anybody else. Becomes accomplished in his profession. And miserable. Gnawing at the back of his mind is the troubling thought that he'd grown up in a family lie. Because there was something wrong with the story of his father's death. He came from a traditional home. And there was no Yahrzeit candle on the anniversary of the death. No Kaddish at Yiskor services. It didn't add up. Somehow he felt that this family secret concealed a shameful reality of which he was part. When he was an adult with teenage children, he learnt that his father hadn't died. There had been a divorce and a collusion. And suddenly, all the doubts about himself surfaced. After a fruitless search for his father over 3 continents and many years, he began to come to terms with the fact that he had created this competent, successful person, but that, like the young lawyer, he was just waiting to be exposed as a phony were the same weaknesses that the father he never knew may have passed on to him. Ask anybody in his community. He was the consummate Adam one. Ask his therapist. The persona, the personality, the ego concealed who he really was. Now, I don't know if any of you are resonating with any of these stories. The second one, incidentally, is my story. But most of us have doubts about ourselves in spite of our accomplishments. What Rosh Hashanah invites us to do and Yom Kippur is to shed the mask. The sages of the Kabbalah have said that Yom Kippurim is Yom Kippurim, that Yom Kippur is like Purim. But there are a number of substantial differences. One of them is that on Purim we put on masks. On Yom Kippur, if we are honest enough, we strip them off. Now, what is the point of this whole teshuvah process? It's when we've stripped off the veneer and when we've validated our neediness and our vulnerability and our frailty and our ephemerality and our transience and our fears. Perhaps we are ready to access who we really are. Because in covering over our disappointments and our losses, and in our need to be successful, we have so surrounded ourselves with this veneer that the light that burns within our heart, our real inner power, the divine within, has been deprived of oxygen. The Kabbalah teaches us, and this is a story which is repeated in the Talmud, ladies and gentlemen, that before we are born, we are exposed to the whole wisdom of the Torah, that we can see from one earth, end of the earth to the other. It's a Gemara in Tractate Nida. Until the angel comes and taps us on our lip and we forget. And what the sages are telling us, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have access to divine knowledge, to divine power, to divine energy. That we have an antenna which can be sharpened and pointed out to receive this inspiration. If only we will strip away our egos. If only we will allow our majesty to rest for a moment and acknowledge our creatureliness as well. We do this, and I would recommend it by setting aside 10 minutes every day for quiet meditation in preparation. There are wonderful meditation CDs. You'll have to wait for a year until Random brings out mine. But there are wonderful meditation CDs, guided meditations. Allow your mind to go to a quiet place, to what Rabbi Nachman called the place of hitbodedut, of being alone with God and with yourself. 10 minutes a day. take your prayer books, and instead of rushing through the words, read yourself and your own experience into those words. When you say that God is somech noflim, He supports the falling, think about how you feel when you're about to fall. When He says rofei cholim, think about how you need Him when you are sick at heart and physically ill. Think about people whom you know who are ill. Take the same words that everybody else is saying and appropriate them for yourself so that you can get in to that inner core. If you do that, then you will have returned not to God alone, but to your own inner power, which you've covered up in your struggle for success. God bless you all.